A friend of mine once had a job actually making a wedding present for Gary Numan. Somebody commissioned him to make a toilet seat with a picture of Gary and his bride-to-be in Star Trek uniforms, and Gary was saving her from a Klingon. So that's just a little link to the first reader. I'm going to read from a novel which I've never read. It's not out yet. It's the first time I've read anything from this in public. It's called My Revolutions, and it's about a guy who gets involved in a leftist armed revolutionary group in the early 70s. So a lot of the action is set in the late 60s and early 70s, but it's framed by a present day story, the present day of which is 1998. And since I'm going to do the same thing and read from the very beginning, I don't think you need any more context than that. Outside in the garden, workmen from the Marquis Company are bolting together an aluminium frame on the lawn. They shout to each other and make jokes, theatrically throwing bolts and brackets to one another across the blossom-strewn patch of grass under the tree. It's an old tree, taller than the house, and in autumn the fruit smashes when it falls to the ground. We should, I suppose, have had it cut down. The men seem happy. Perhaps it's because they work in an atmosphere of constant pre-party excitement. Perhaps celebration gets inside them. The secret of the good life, putting up tents. Other people are out there too, caterers, a delivery driver, all preparing for the big do. Miranda has gone out for something or other, ribbon or flowers or place cards. For once, she said, she wanted me to be the centre of attention. She knew I wouldn't approve, but everyone deserved the chance to wish me a happy 50th. Everyone, I thought. Everyone. They're her friends, really, but I knew how kindly it was meant. And I found myself looking forward to my party. For a long time, more than half my life, if you want to look at it that way, I've avoided large gatherings. It's become instinctive, part of my personality. However, during the last few years, I've started to lower my guard a little, which, karma-wise, as Miranda would say meaninglessly, seems to have been a mistake. I look away from the window. The study's been transmuted by Miles's visit. It's as if by coming here he's put the room in brackets. The oak desk, silted with spreadsheets and reports, the shelves of books, even the chipped grey filing cabinet has taken on a provisional, insubstantial look. The party preparations going on outside, which are, I have no doubt, at the very centre of Miranda's consciousness, feel to me as if they're taking place on TV, a scene from one of those early evening dramas where well-heeled suburbanites experience a little formulaic frisson in their lives, romance or a murder mystery. The workmen are laying out a white awning beside the metal frame. I sit very still, not wanting to disturb the atmosphere of the room, the pattern of the life I've led in it. Miranda will be back soon. What will I say to her? What is there I can say? Voices in the hall. Not Miranda or Sam, not yet. I open the study door and meet two young guys, all gum and hair gel, carrying musical equipment. They ask where it should go, and I hear myself give them directions, modulating through a series of cheery cadences. Mine host, the birthday boy, his mask still more or less intact under pressure. I have to be clear. It's already over. All this. The house, my family, this ridiculous party, no longer exists. But accepting that doesn't mean I know what to do next, and even if I choose to do nothing, events will carry on unfolding, and very soon now, in days or even hours, my life here will be over. In the sitting room there's a photo of Miranda, which I took on a cold weekend walk at the Norfolk coast. She's standing with her back to the camera, looking out to sea. The light is coming straight at the lens, and she's little more than a silhouette. Big boots, narrow shoulders wrapped in an ethnic something or other, hair streaming in the wind. Somehow that's the image that comes to me. Frail, romantic Miranda, rather than the arranger of breakfast meetings, the recipient of local Chamber of Commerce awards, the Miranda of the last few years. Soon a wave is going to break over her. Police. Maybe the media. How will she cope? I wish I could feel optimistic, but Miranda isn't a person who deals well with the world's unpredictability. She's always fought hard against randomness, with all the weapons in the stationers, the little arsenal of agendas and diaries and wall planners dotted with coloured stars. Poor Miranda. No amount of post-its will ward off what's about to happen to you. You are utterly unprepared. The stairs creak as I climb up to the bedroom. I have to duck my head to go through the door. I've never found the low ceilings and narrow corridors of country cottages quaint, at least not straightforwardly. They're scaled to the small stature of poorly nourished people, an architecture of hardship and deprivation. Of course, I've never said this to Miranda. Irregular walls and creaking floorboards please her. I think she'd like to forget she was born into an industrial society. I can't, at least not in the same way. That kind of mystification has never seemed right to me. It's so incoherent, for one thing. A country life, but with plumbing and telecoms and antibiotics. A rich person's fantasy. But this is our house, or rather Miranda's house, the house she allowed me to share and always wanted me to love as she did. I realise I'm standing with my fists clenched, glaring at the William Morris wallpaper, the patchwork cushions on the armchair. Above our bed, hanging from the oak beam, is a dream catcher. I tug at it, breaking the string. I've wanted to do that for so long. Such an absurd, out-of-place thing. Our house is filled with these little objects, tribal, spiritual, handcrafted knick-knacks, which are supposed to edge us clear nearer to Miranda's wish-fulfillment future of agrarian harmony. There are corn dollies and old glass bottles and prints of medicinal herbs with quotations from Culpeper printed underneath in calligraphic lettering. Only from lucre of money they cheat you and tell you it is a kind of tear or some such thing that drops from poppies when they weep. That's outside the bathroom. Culpeper is natural, and natural is the flag Miranda waves at the world, the banner standing for righteousness and truth. Why am I doing this? Breaking her things. None of it's her fault. She's worked hard to make the life she wanted. She's tried to be a good person, and she's loved me. I know what will be the most terrible thing. The look on her face, the gradual opening of the abyss, everything she's known or believed about me, her lover, her partner for 15 years, the man who's been a stepfather to her daughter, is untrue. Or if not untrue, for I've tried not to tell unnecessary lies, then partial, incomplete. Listen to me, partial, incomplete. I'm even lying to myself. It could hardly be worse. She doesn't even know my real name. My bowels are loose. I lock myself into the bathroom among the lavender bunches and embroidered hand towels and the rows of Bount Essence products in their little recyclable bottles. Bount Essence is the highest expression of Miranda's romance with nature. Bount Essence is Miranda, though in public it's the two of us because I still cling on to some undefined administrative role and occasionally squire the boss to events and dinners in the West Sussex area. I'm a sort of Dennis to her Margaret. Michael Frame and Miranda Martin of Bount Essence Natural Beauty Care. It's peculiar. Those words make no sense to me. I can't connect myself with them or with the couple they represent. They're just sounds. Ever since I became Michael Frame all those years ago, I've existed in a kind of mental crouch. When I was a child, I used to have night terrors. Not quite dreams, more semi-conscious imaginings that took on narrative form like scenes from films. In one recurrent situation, I was wedged under the floorboards, holding my breath and waiting for the German soldiers to stop searching the attic where I was hiding. I could hear the clatter of their boots, a guttural voice barking orders. I used to lie rigid under the covers, the blood pounding in my head, my entire consciousness occupied by the effort of not making a noise. I think when I went underground, those night terrors colonized my waking life. Remaining undetected has consumed all my energy, has hollowed out my sense of self. Nothing that's taken place in the meantime has ever felt quite real. Except that tomorrow Mike Frame will be 50, 5 weeks after me. This life, this Michael Frame life has been it. This is what I have had. I flush the toilet and wash my hands in the basin, trying not to look in the mirror. What will happen to Miranda? Will she have to move away? She's put so much into this house. If she's very lucky, they might leave her alone. Maybe it won't make any difference to the world at large what I did. Maybe it will end with the two of us. And maybe she'll find a way to feel we did have a connection. Although there were things she didn't know, there were also things she did, which were important and real. I could say that to her. I could say, maybe one day you'll come to understand and find consolation. But would I believe it? Not really. And would she? I don't know. Because I don't know if it's true about understanding and consolation, and I'm not certain we had anything at all. Miranda will be back soon. She's allowed Sam to drive her to the shops in her 19th birthday present, a second-hand Fiesta. I'm just going to have to get rid of this screensaver. There you go. So Miranda will be back soon. She's allowed Sam to drive her to the shops in her 19th birthday present, a second-hand Fiesta. An act of faith on Miranda's part. She's a nervous passenger, and Sam only passed her test a few weeks ago. Sam's room is just as she left it at the start of term, a neat row of shoes in front of the cupboard, the pile of outgrown soft toys on the bed. An orderly and rather conventional room. Only the backpack and the Discman dumped on the bed signal that despite the argument we had last week, she's come down from university for Mike's officially becoming ancient party. I can't imagine what this will do to her. The media circus, the betrayal of trust. There's a chance she could just shrug it off. She's a practical girl and startlingly worldly for a 19-year-old, at least as I would have judged a 19-year-old of my generation. Certainly, Sam isn't your idealistic type of law student, interested in writing injustice or fighting for the little man. She says she wants to do corporate, because that's where the money is. And I think because she knows it scandalizes her mother and me. Little Sam and her embarrassing hippie parents. By now, Soma will be off her passport, too. She hasn't allowed us to call her that for years. Fuck, I can't do it. I can't face you, Sam. There's no way. Working quickly, I open cupboards and pull out a sport bag, start stuffing in socks, underwear, a couple of shirts. I need to move fast before they get back from the shops. My passport's in the study in a box file, at least that's where I think it is. I check and find it isn't, and for the first time since Miles left, I lose control. When you panic, you forget to breathe and your heart rate rises. I know this. I tell it to myself. But things start to speed up, and soon I'm sweeping papers onto the floor, pulling out drawers and sobbing with rage and frustration. Outside there's the sound of a car and I freeze, but it isn't them, just one of the marquee riggers. At last I spot the passport on a bookshelf. Frame Michael David, British citizen, 10th of April 48. British citizen is the only part which is true. 5 minutes later I'm in Miranda's big silver BMW, approaching the junction with the ring road. I head out of town and along the coast toward New Haven, obsessively checking the rearview mirror to see if I'm being followed. A blue Sierra preoccupies me, then disappears at a set of traffic lights. I'm so busy staring at it that I narrowly avoid rear-ending the car in front as it slows for a turn. What am I worried about? By now, Sam and Miranda will have got back home. Before long, they'll realize I've gone. So, what's left to salvage? At the port, I pull into the ferry terminal and park between cars packed with luggage and fighting children, all waiting to be transported across the channel for the holidays. I only really admit to myself where I'm heading as I queue for a ticket. What am I doing for time? Okay, I'll carry on for a bit. Last year, I made this journey with Miranda. She was exhausted. Over time, the business, which once involved filling little bottles on the kitchen table, has grown slowly but steadily into a substantial operation. It now consumes all of her energies. Bountessence sells beauty products, face cream and shampoo and conditioner and massage oil and so on, through a network of telesales agents, mostly women, some working at home and others in an office above a tanning salon in the town centre. When I met her, Miranda was making the stuff herself, boiling witchy cauldrons on the hob at her flat. Now, her ladies, as she insists on calling them, sell factory-made natural botanicals on commission to customers whose names appear on a list she rents from a marketing agency in London. A surprising number of people don't seem to mind being phoned by strangers to talk about moisturiser. and lately Miranda has begun to glimpse a grand and lucrative future. I insisted on the holiday. I wanted to slow things down. She'd just secured funding for further expansion and was looking at space in an industrial park. There was talk of online sales and meetings with a brand consultant, whatever one of those is. When she came home from signing the contract with her new investors, a pair of ambitious local solicitors, I expected her to be elated. Instead, she sat and sipped pennyroyal tea in the garden, fidgety and withdrawn. Unlike me, Miranda has the knack of living in the world. Almost effortlessly, she seems to find herself on the crest of whatever preoccupation is currently sweeping the lunch table or the Sunday supplements. I've come to think of it as a gift. It isn't something she works at. Miranda certainly isn't a modish person, at least not consciously. In the last few years, everyone around us has become very excited by money. And sure enough, her talent has led her to it, like an ant following a pheromone trail. There used to be a contradiction between money and Miranda, a short circuit. Like me, she belongs to a generation whose selfishness was tempered by a more than passing interest in renunciation. We had the notion that in some variously defined way, simplicity was glamorous, hip. So although she's now a thrusting entrepreneur of the type celebrated in the glossy magazines she buys with increasing frequency, M remains conflicted about consumerism. I diagnosed her silent tea drinking as a symptom of guilt, the unease of a woman who'd once spoken about alternative lifestyles with the emphasis on alternative rather than lifestyles. Or maybe she was just tired. Either way, I could tell she wasn't sure that expansion was what she wanted, and I had my own private reasons to worry. I was being stretched thin by Miranda's ambitions. It was increasingly hard for me to keep a channel open to something important, something I don't really have a name for any longer. An ideal, maybe, that I'm not comfortable with the world. A vision of the future? Perhaps just to a person. Someone I never was, but once hoped to become. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Harry.